Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. We know this, and yet we ignore it. To us, beauty has become a set of exclusive traits and features, growing farther and farther out of reach. But as times change, so do our standards, and you'll find they've come to represent much more than what we deem beautiful. Hello, and welcome to the Zed Files. My name is Nina, and I'm here to talk about history. Not all history, just the history I want. And today, I want to talk about the evolution of Western female beauty standards. So the main historical component for this episode will be investigating beauty standards over the past 100 years. Well, technically, I'll be doing the past 120 years, but that doesn't sound as cool, so 100 it is. But my goal is not just to tell you what people were wearing in the 40s versus the 50s. I'm gonna try and explain the socioeconomic factors that influence the creation of these standards, and maybe offer some insight, or my opinion, if I feel like I have something worth sharing. Because I think oftentimes our beauty standards represent a lot more than what initially comes to the eye. Overall, I could do a very political episode on this topic, and it probably won't be that. I just wrote 2 episodes on the Atlantic slave trade, which is incredibly political, so part of the appeal for talking about beauty standards is that the stakes are not as high. But I do want to acknowledge that in most cases, there is a lot more than just beauty at play. It's got ties to racism, classism, etc. However, I am not planning on attacking all of this in this episode. I'll just be sort of explaining the different trends and reflecting on them. Why am I doing this, you ask? Well, how many times have you heard someone explain the 20th century through the lens of what we consider beautiful? Okay, a few clarifications. This episode will be focusing on Western beauty standards. And yes, in the last episode, I said I would be leaning away from Western-focused episodes, but you know what? My podcast, my rules. And additionally, I'm a Westerner. This is my bubble of knowledge and understanding. At least in the case of beauty standards, I have first-hand knowledge, and I feel comfortable making claims and assumptions. However, in a culture that is not my own, I would be much less equipped. But I do want to make it clear that I am, at least in this episode, only going to be talking about beauty standards in the Western world. I'm not claiming that these are global. And I will also primarily be talking about those of which pertain to women. And this is not me denying the existence of men's beauty standards. They exist, but their role in society is very different to that of women's, especially in the past. This episode will also probably feel like it's moving pretty quickly. I only have about 20 minutes to fit in 120 years of beauty. Let me start by defining beauty standards. For the purpose of this podcast, beauty standards are the individual qualifications women are expected to meet in order to embody the, quote, feminine beauty ideal, and thus succeed personally and professionally. The terms woman and feminine are being used because the concepts of beauty standards and the feminine beauty ideal were deliberately built on the gender binary. Additionally, I will not be defining woman because I'm not J.K. Rowling. We made up gender, so go ahead and define it however you want. But that's a whole other conversation, so let's get into beauty standards. The last thing I want to say, though, before I get into the episode is that there will be explicit discussion of different body types in this episode, which I know can be very, very triggering for some people. I don't actually believe that trigger warnings are super effective because a lot of people look for things to trigger themselves, but if you know that's you, I'm telling you right now, put the episode down, just turn off your phone and go watch Teletubbies. Okay, now that they're gone, I want to give a little background knowledge around what beauty looked like further back in history. What was considered beautiful throughout history was influenced by similar factors to what it is now, such as class, race, gender, and the political climate. For example, I'm sure you've seen artwork from earlier periods in history, whether really far back in ancient Greece, or slightly more recently in the Italian Renaissance. And I assume you've probably noticed that there tends to be a common theme within depictions of women in earlier works. They're often drawn quite fuller than modern models are. The reason for this is that throughout most early periods of history, being rounder and plumper was a sign of wealth. It meant you had money, and as a result, an abundance of food. The skinny ideal that we obsess over today has only become a trend as wealth has become associated with smaller bodies. This is because cheaper foods, such as fast food, is what's become available to those living in poverty. And this connection has caused us to associate obesity with poverty now. Oh, how the tables have turned. I will say, though, class is just one reason why we idolize thin bodies these days. There are many others, including race. But let me actually begin with the turn of the century in the early 1900s. Women were still wearing corsets, but fuller bodies were also still all the rage. The corset helped create the desired shape. Women wanted small waists and full hips and busts. The aim of the corset was to show off one's curves. The early 1900s gave us the birth of the famous Gibson girl. This trend continued throughout the early 1910s. But what is the Gibson girl, and where did it come from? Well, with the beginning of World War I, almost all factories were being worked by women, while the men were away. And as we all know, the suffragist movement was thriving. And a popular illustrator named Charles Gibson decided to draw the ideal modern woman, the 20th century woman. She was kind, soft, and designed to look aspirational for women. She was curvy, but had a small waist, sloped shoulders, but a long neck. And she was very quickly becoming the standard. There was now a political and social focus on women that hadn't really existed before, and this is what allowed the Gibson girl to become so popular. And after the drawing's publication on the covers of a few magazines, women were obsessed. There wasn't a girl around who wasn't aspiring to look like the illustrations of an old white guy named Charles Gibson. You might think that at a time when women were starting to speak up for themselves, they wouldn't be that keen on the idea of looking like a drawing by a man that depicted the so-called perfect woman. It's an oxymoron, you see. Gibson presented the drawing as the new woman, the suffragist woman, the free woman, when in reality it was just the opposite. Hindsight is 20/20, right? Looking back, we can now see that Charles Gibson's drawings were oppressive, because we know that holding women to a specific standard, especially when it's created by a man, is not liberating at all. Now, this is not to say that Charles Gibson was a raging misogynist. I didn't know the guy. I don't know if he did this intentionally. I think you'll find it's a common trend with these, well, trends, that the goal of the changing standard is to liberate women or be freed from the oppressive standards of our parents' generation. But they just end up trapped in a different oppressive trend. It's like a really vicious cycle. And a really good example of it is the 1920s and the age of the flapper. The flapper's ideals represented a big shift, both from the standards of the past decade, but also for the ideals of the past centuries. Round bodies with full breasts and butts were out. Flat-chested, boyish figures were in. World War I was over, and people were ready to party. Women felt liberated. Were they actually? No. But they were kicking against the ideals of the past generation. They cut their hair short, bound their chests, and opted for a much more loose-fitting attire. And for the first time in recent history, women were aspiring to be thin. This was likely because, prior to the 20s, mirrors and scales were not common, and only accessible to the uber-rich. So the ability to see your whole body and weigh yourself was reserved for the 1%. However, because of the Industrial Revolution, bathroom scales were becoming more accessible, and department stores with giant mirrors were popping up all over the place. This allowed women to see themselves frequently, for the first time. And as we all know way too well, this made it easy for them to notice how big or small they were and all their little flaws, igniting our modern version of beauty obsession. Here's what I find interesting about the flapper. The curvy, fertile, and for lack of a better word, feminine look was out. Girls didn't want to look like girls, they wanted to look like boys, look hipless and bustless. And a lot of people will attribute the flapper mentality to the entrance of women in the workforce. And this desire to look more boyish could be a direct result of that. It's likely that women felt insecure about the fact that they were women, and in order to compensate for that, they tried to look like men. Dresses were shapeless and boxy, they cut their hair, they were partying and smoking. They really were the polar opposite to what would be stereotypically considered feminine. But my point is, think about the fact that the standard of beauty for women was to look like a guy. That feels very indicative of the gender power imbalance. Who knows, maybe I'm reading into it. But all the flapper fun ended with the Wall Street crash of 1929. Now there was no money, and it was no longer a time for celebration. Okay, let me be frank. The Depression made it difficult for women to care about how skinny they were, so fuller bodies were coming back into fashion. I can only assume that another contributing factor was class, like I described earlier. Naturally, when a huge chunk of the population was unemployed and impoverished, being skinny once again became a sign of a lack of wealth. We weren't quite at the era of fast food yet, so if you were bigger and curvier, you were assumed to be wealthier. Looking stick thin looked like you were starving. Being voluptuous meant you were eating well. However, it was a pretty unrealistic standard for most women at the time. Yeah, funny how that always seems to happen. In terms of fashion during this period, it was becoming much more practical. It's actually one of the first times that we see women wear pants like men did. And this was because many women were having to get creative with their clothing and were reworking men's clothes into women's. Among the wealthy, longer dresses were coming back, as opposed to the shorter dresses that were popular amongst the flappers. These dresses were glamorous, silky, and were much more form-fitting, accentuating natural feminine features. Women of this generation were embracing natural waistlines, making femininity cool again. The 40s, though, were all about the war effort. Like, seriously, World War II had a huge impact on the beauty standards. Everything in the 40s was all about the military. It was practical, pretty boring, and padded. For real, shoulder pads were a thing. Beauty standards are like a pendulum, right? Swinging back and forth from one trend and back again. Because of the war, more boyish and boxy figures were in again. The ideal body type was inspired by the military, so everything was very, very angular. The absolute nightmare that is torpedo bras. The pointy ones were a trend. Leaner bodies were also celebrated again, but this time it was because of rationing for the war. If you're skinny, it didn't mean that you were poor. It meant that you were doing your part for the war effort. But I'm gonna be honest, I don't have that much to say about the 40s. People were so focused on the war that idealist beauty standards kinda took a back seat. However, the 50s, yeah, I got stuff to say about them. Curves were back. Fashion, pendulum. Once you learn about the past trends, it becomes really easy to predict new ones. But the trends of the 50s all started with one woman. When an upcoming actress admitted that she'd posed for nudes for Playboy magazine, she was propelled into the spotlight and would come to represent everything the 50s are known for. Can you guess who it was? Marilyn Monroe was the standard of beauty. She wasn't stick thin like the previous decade, and people today might even consider her plus-sized. Granted, she's still very skinny, however, she just wasn't the same kind of skinny. She had boobs and a butt, and when you compare her to today's models, yes, she looks bigger. However, very soon, all women wanted to look like her, so much so that people were selling butt pads and weight-gaining supplements. At the same time, another trend perpetuated by Marilyn Monroe was also gaining popularity. Women were starting, keyword starting, to own their sexualities. Women were starting to dabble in being a little more provocative and showing a little more skin. The embracement of femininity and sexuality can be seen as a reaction to the harsh regulations of wartime. A stronger economy was starting to return to the West. So, the same way the flappers did in the 1920s, women in the 1950s were letting loose, starting to enjoy themselves again and kicking against the restrictive ideals of the prior generation. Only to end up creating just as a restrictive ideal for the new generation. The 1960s represent another big swing for beauty standards in the way of skinny bodies, but this time it never really swings back. So the economy is still strong, and partying and enjoying yourself is very much embedded in the culture at the time. However, what I find sort of interesting about that is this is the first generation where there isn't some world-shattering event that causes the standard to change. There's no economic crash. And yes, there was the Vietnam War, but its influence is not seen in beauty standards the same way as World War I and World War II. So, it's one of the first times that we see beauty standards change naturally. The 60s represent the birth of many trends, one of which being androgyny, something that would return many times throughout the years, most prominently in the 90s. The 60s have a lot in common with the 90s, in terms of body type as well. It's not quite harem chic yet, but it was the skinniest ideal ever at that point in history. Models like Twiggy were representing this new wave. In the earlier years of the decade, the British mod look was in. This is the miniskirt and colorful prints you likely picture when thinking of 60s fashion. However, later in the decade, we get some of my favorite people of all time, the hippies. My current fashion is often very heavily inspired by these true icons. Hippies wore loose-fitting clothes, and it was often a direct contrast with the popular mod look. They were rebelling against wearing makeup, padded bras, girdles, and stockings. And they wore tie-dye, and bell-bottom jeans, and maxi skirts. But we can't talk about the 60s without talking about second-wave feminism. This was huge, and women once again felt like they were being freed from the ideals of the 1950s. Although it seems like even though they thought they were being freed from the past ideals, all they were doing were setting new ones. And since skinny was pretty, women were now turning to diet culture to achieve the particular look. In the 70s, there wasn't much change in terms of body standards. Thin was still in, however, likely as a result of the hippie movement, women were embracing a more natural body. Don't get me wrong, it was still very skinny, but it was a much more natural skinny, especially compared to the 60s, where it was, like, aggressively skinny. Models in the 70s were larger than Twiggy, but still very small. In the 70s, people were embracing and expressing their own personalities. Bright colors and tactile fabrics like velvet and corduroy were in. And the disco dance craze was setting the scene for the aerobics-obsessed 1980s. After the dance revolution, it was an easy transition to the trend that would dominate the 1980s. Aerobics. In 1982, Jane Fonda released her first workout video, and nobody could have predicted how much of a success it would be. All the stars aligned perfectly, and for the first time, women were working out to intentionally shape their bodies. Health and fitness was all the rage, and as a result of this, women embraced leggings and spandex, almost like side effects of the fitness revolution. The 80s were the decade of excess. People had disposable income, the mentality was the bigger the better. The 80s also introduced the tan trend, where white girls would intentionally make their skin darker and be called beautiful for it, while women with naturally dark skin were called ghetto for it. Women were tall and fit, big boobs were in again, but hips were still narrower. And this perfect storm of events, the fitness craze and the consumerism boom, made it the perfect time for the modeling industry to bring on the supermodels. Big brands had started advertising on TVs and billboards, which meant that models were more accessible. They were not only seen on runways and magazines now, and this allowed them to become global superstars and gained as much popularity as any actor or musician would have at the time. Supermodels like Naomi Campbell and Cindy Crawford represented the new health-crazed woman. They were tall, athletic, and paired perfectly with the changing standards. However, the 90s took a turn for the worst, and health was out. In the early 90s, heroin began to gain a foothold among the wealthy and middle class, and became purer and more accessible. It started to influence pop culture, with massive films like Pulp Fiction giving it the time of day. Maybe it was as a rebellion against the health and fitness-obsessed ideals of the 80s that pushed women to idolize an unhealthy and drug addiction-inspired body, but very quickly, heroin chic was in, and health was out. This trend was the antichrist to those of the 1980s. And it didn't take long for the modeling and film industry to begin to feature pale-skinned and very skinny girls, led by models like Kate Moss. However, this did receive quite a bit of pushback, even at the time, as people didn't like the glamorization of drug culture. So, for the most part, heroin chic's lifespan wasn't too long. But even if its direct influence from drug culture disappeared, its influence was felt, and the 90s generally favored a much skinnier body. But the 2000s was about to give us a new look. In 1999, Vogue dubbed Brazilian supermodel Gisele Bündchen the return of the sexy model. Heroin chic and an aggressively skinny body was out, and fitness had returned to Hollywood and the mainstream media. The new look was once again to be tan, with a flat, more athletic stomach and boobs. Cue Britney Spears. With the return of fitness, celebrity trainers were gaining platforms, as everybody wanted to know exactly what celebrities were doing what to look like them. I love the early 2000s, and the 2020s are poised for a Y2K comeback. And I cannot wait. Here we are, everyone. We've made it to the end. The 2010s marked maybe the biggest shift in body ideals since the 60s. The Kardashians brought back the curves. Big boobs and big butts were back. At least in some areas of the internet. Stars like Nicki Minaj and J-Lo played a role in this as well. And for the first time in decades, skinny wasn't always better. This trend takes off all over social media. Instagram and TikTok especially are some of the biggest transmitters of it. However, it doesn't take off in all areas, especially more traditional medias, like film and the modeling industry, where skinnier bodies are still favored. Think Kendall Jenner, Zendaya, Gigi, and Bella Hadid. But this might not even matter because research is showing that we spend more time now on digital media such as Instagram and TikTok as opposed to more traditional media, at least in the US. So this means that there's been a shift in where we are finding and celebrating our new ideals. But the 2010s is also home to the body positivity movement. And although we still have standards and ideals being pushed at women from left, right, and center, women are also working towards embracing and loving themselves regardless of what they look like. A trend I hope will continue in the 2020s. But what do the 2020s have in store? Let's take a look forward. Like I mentioned earlier, the rate at which we consume media is the fastest it's ever been, so we're about to see trends pop up and disappear faster than ever. Additionally, social media divides us into categories. Everybody is able to find their own niche. And so people start to be exposed to different trends that aren't as global as before. Instead, a trend can pop up within a subculture. So we can predict that things are going to be pretty crazy from here on out. Throughout the 2010s, we saw the rise of the body positivity movement. And personally, through my experience on TikTok and other social medias, I'm only seeing this movement grow. However, since doing the research on trends and beauty standards over the years, I feel like I have to ask if body positivity itself is a trend. Are we going to see the next generation rebel against our inclusivity and once again create a new standard for women and men? And I would say that most women, especially within the body positivity movement, would see it as women's liberation, when in reality, are we just getting more unrealistic standards for women? Such as being confident in your body no matter what its shape? I'm asking questions, these are not my opinions. I'm wholeheartedly on the side of body positivity regardless of the answers. However, after doing the research and recognizing the trends and paths female beauty standards take, I had to ask. Beauty standards are complicated. We idealize being skinny now because it's associated with wealth and whiteness, but in the past, we did the opposite. That just shows you how stupid and arbitrary these things are. Girls now are obsessed with having big boobs and a big butt and big lips, which is the natural body shape for many black women, who for decades were scrutinized for it and called racial slurs by the same people who now get plastic surgery to look like them. What, 'cause Kim Kardashian does it, it's cool now? I know this is just the tip of the iceberg. I could make a whole podcast episode about how beauty standards act as a reflection of our internalized biases, and how until we dismantle racism, classism, ableism, etc., we can never hope to truly liberate women from the feminine beauty ideal. I used quite a few sources for this video. I would like to thank Natasha Ocean for her incredible video on what the perfect body looked like throughout the years. She was very useful and gave me the idea for this episode, so check that out if you are interested. I also gotta say, I read a Teen Vogue article on the oppressive nature of beauty standards, and I was thoroughly impressed. Teen Vogue really pulled out all the stops for that, so you might want to try it. It's quite interesting. As usual, all my sources will be linked down below, and I encourage you to do your own research. I doubt you will be disappointed. Okay, thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate it. I hope you enjoyed it. It is International Women's Month, so it felt appropriate to do something about women. Just remember that if you are celebrating International Women's Month, celebrate all women, not just the white ones. But anyway, thank you so much for listening. I'm very grateful. And I hope I will see you back here next week.